You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
My shapeshifter this evening, which is really a conversation I am excited about, is Ntate Mpho Makwana, who is an accomplished business leader with a diverse experience acquired over 32 years overall, 26 of which have been in executive and C-suite roles in the public and private sector. He is the immediate past non-executive chairman of the Nedbank Group Limited, Nedbank LTD. His term, of course, concluded on the 2nd of June 2023. Until Monday, the 30th of October 2023, Mpho was chairman of the Eskom State-Owned Company Limited Board of Directors after a short term of 12 months. He is currently a non-executive director of Platinum Group Metals and a lead independent director on the board of Invicta Holdings Limited. He further serves as chairman of Epitome Investments, his family investment holding company, which holds equity interest in LPI, which is the Lion Pride Investments, and LRMG there. So that's a beautiful one there. And of course, his board alliance as well, and Boardroom Alliance Africa, trading as executive search for Hendrick and Struggles. And also he plows back, by the way, which is another one that is really exciting for me. He plows back to society in many ways. In June 2023, he was appointed as the adjacent professor at UNISA's CEMS, which is the College of Economic and Management Sciences. I'm an alumni, by the way, of that college, so from UNISA. He also volunteers as a trustee on the board of the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund, as well as the board director of FLG Moody's Pentecost Foundation. Well, in terms of qualifications, he has a Bachelor of Administration, UniZulu, BA Admin Honours from the University of Pretoria, Executive Development Programme, of course, and then the Kellogg School of Management and Postgrad Diploma, Retailing Management, and the University of Stirling. Where do I even start except to say, Dumela Ntate Makwana.
Dumela Ntate
Makwana. Le kae ntate.
Reteng,
and that show, what a long history there. I'm sure listening to that, you're like, yo, have I done all of these things until now? How are you today, Ntate?
No, I'm very well, thank you. I hope you're also well.
I'm fantastic. Thank you so much, Nat. I know you're very busy, but thank you so much for taking the time to join us this evening. I've been looking forward to this conversation. How was your day, though?
I had a fulfilling day.
Yeah.
I've just come back from a burial in the Eastern Cape, in rural Eastern Cape. We were burying one of the priests in our faith community.
Yeah. Oh, condolences on that one. Condolences on that one. All right. And that's my one. I want to start here, firstly. Do you have time to yourself?
I absolutely do. When you have... I guess the myriad of responsibilities that you've sketched out.
Yeah,
you've got to have a sense of compass that you use to navigate your life. And in that sense of compass, you've got to ensure that you've factored in what I call me time.
Yeah.
So yes, I do. I do have time for myself.
Oh, fantastic. All right. That's really amazing. All right. This segment at Demagwana is, we call it Shapeshifter. And basically here we bring people like yourselves, you know, to try and encourage young people. Some might be looking up to you as well. And maybe can't even get the opportunity to get to know you, where you come from. How did you even make it to be where you are today? That's the whole point of this particular conversation. So I want to take you just a step. In fact, a couple of steps back. Where were you born, Ntate Makwana?
I was born in a place that historically would have been called Lady Selborne.
Okay.
At the Holy Cross Hospital.
Yeah.
But when I was born some 53 or so years ago,
yeah,
there were still rules that said you couldn't be registered as being born in a white area.
Yes.
So my birth certificate says I was born at Kalafong Hospital, but actually I was born at Holy Cross.
Oh, okay. That is, of course, the previous dispensation.
Yes, so Holy Cross was in Lady Selborne, which at the time was marked as a white area.
Ah, fantastic, fantastic. And where exactly is this? Which province? I mean, I'm trying to locate it in my mind.
It's in Pretoria West. So
in Pretoria West.
Lady Selborne is along the what is known as the Mabopane Highway,
yes.
Cederberg. Kalafong Hospital is in Attridgeville. Mm. My grandfather and his family lived in Pretoria at the time. My parents, who were newlyweds, kind of run about almost a year, newlyweds at the time. As it happens in any tradition, when you have your first child as a newlywed young woman, the traditions in our families as Africans is that generally your maternal mother, your mother is generally the person that you would feel most comfortable to have them take you through your first journey of becoming a mom. So my mother then would have been with her mother in Attridgeville at the time of my birth.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. I see the Mabopane Highway that you're talking about. Now, what were the social, cultural challenges, landscape? What did it look like at the time when you were growing up there?
So my formative years were in a village in Skukuni where my parents had their home.
Yeah.
Called Jane First. It derives its name from the Jane First Memorial Hospital, which was the first health institution in that environment of Skukuni.
Yeah.
That was set up by the Anglican Church missionaries in 1966.
Yeah.
So my upbringing would have been as African as most would have been for the first 6 years in that. In the first 6 years of my formative years, I attended primary school like everybody in the village, had the occasional moment of walking barefoot to school. And so it would have been a typical village boy upbringing. At the time, we didn't have tar roads in Jane First, so it was quite a dusty area. Jane First was like a melting point.
Yeah.
So if you know of the NRC buses, National Roads Council buses, and also the then South African Spoorweë buses, they all came from the then South, a.k.a. Makgoeng.
Yeah.
You know, carrying all manner of migrant workers that would have gone to work in the urban areas of Johannesburg, Middelburg, Witbank in the power stations and the mines. And so Jane First was an important exchange point.
Sure.
Those proceeding to other villages would catch on minibuses. Those proceeding to other smaller towns like Burgersfort, Steelport would then proceed with other buses from those service providers at that time.
Sure. I can imagine it must have been a very busy place.
It was generally busy, good busy.
Okay.
It was also a good melting pot of cultures in that most of the medical doctors came from Scotland and the UK. Notably, one of the legendary superintendents of the time was Dr. Davis, nicknamed Muisho because of the distinct spectacles that he wore at the time. The First family themselves would have been legendary in that, firstly, Dr. John First was the first doctor and superintendent at the hospital. His daughter, Jane, contracted polio at the age of 13, and so passed on in the hospital, under the care of the hospital, and became therefore perhaps immortalized in the naming of the. So the hospital is called Jane First Memorial Hospital. Named after her.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And generally, the young people at the time, were there the kind of social, economic challenges that we are seeing today? And I suppose challenges such as unemployment, which then leads to young people getting into drug usage and drug abuse and all that. And what sheltered you from those if you were cushioned a little bit from them?
Well, remember that at the time in the early 70s, growing up as a young boy in South Africa, that was in apartheid South Africa. So Jane First fell under the homeland of Lebowa. And so the design of the government and political system at the time was geared towards preparing a black child for a certain reality of serving a dispensation that would have perpetuated their inferiority. The challenges we would have faced is that at the primary school we would have had limited. So I think we were rescued by the fact that Jane First was essentially a diverse, let's call it a cosmopolitan village, which exposed you to multiple nationalities through the hospital facility. Next to the hospital was the post office, which was also a landmark building. That meant that various department and post and telecoms at the time, technicians coming to fix telephone lines, coming to fix all manner of things from different races, we would be exposed to. While being in a essentially black, Bapedi monolithical culture in the primary school, then adjacent to the hospital, there were two missionary presences, the presence of the Anglican Church missionaries who also were multicultural. At the time, in the first 6 years of my life, my family was Methodist, so there was also a multicultural, both in terms of the Xhosa, you know, reverence that we had at the time, that came from the Eastern Cape on posting to the Jane First missionary of the Methodist Church. I remember at that time the reverend was Reverend Njunje. And so that would have been the first kind of Xhosa family culture would have been exposed to through that experience. But remember also, Jane First was at the time highly renowned for high standards of health care because of the multinational or international exposure to different medical professionals. And so even though it was in Lebowa, you would see trainee nurses from many parts of the world, of the country rather, of different ilks, be they from KZN, be they from again Eastern Cape and other parts, because it had a college as well on site.
Fantastic, nice picture there. And I suppose all of that conflating of the cultures, different people and all that, would you say that type of upbringing had an impact in the person that you turned out to be today?
Yes, I think it shaped you to become a, firstly, global citizen in spite of the homeland and apartheid circumstances. Shaped you to have an inquisitive mind. I mean, one other place that later would become instrumental in my teenage years now as a scholar at boarding school is that at the height of when we were all conscientized with the spirit of ungovernability, the spirit of no give up and all that under student politics, one would then find intellectual stimulation in the adjacent missionary church of the Lutheran church. I always tell Mr. Minella that in his father, the late Ntate Dean Minele.
Yeah.
We have a shared father.
Yeah.
In that he always had time for young people.
Yeah.
And there were always German exchange students that came through the Lutheran Church. And there was this very significant caravan on their premises that served as a library.
Okay.
The only equivalent of a library facility in Jane First. And therefore, being in that facility meant, again, you got exposed to another cohort of international perspective, let's call it, from Germany.
Ah, fantastic. Okay. Boarding school, let's talk about that. Did you enjoy it? Was it nice? Did you even have a sense of what type of career trajectory you'd like to follow at that time?
So the boarding school that I went to was, in a sense, an apartheid homeland experiment.
Yeah.
In part, it became a successful experiment because the school today even continues to produce top class matriculants. I went to a school for the first, for 5 years, but I didn't finish my matric. I'll share later why. SJ Van der Merwe Technical High School was its original name.
Okay.
Skalk Jacobus Van der Merwe was an executive, senior executive in the mining sector who decided through his trust to donate an endowment to the Boer government to develop such a school.
Yeah.
Later, maybe let me first say that in Standard 6, we were the second cohort. The first cohort was about 25 learners. We then became the second cohort with an additional about 25 or so. And the whole school was just under 50 learners. And so every year as learners went into a higher grade until the first matrix, the enrollment would grow. And also as the school diversified to being both a technical and a commercial high school, the enrollment changed. And that's really where I would say I cut my teeth in student politics for the first time when I joined COSAS or was recruited into COSAS, which at the time, just as we were recruited, was already a banned sort of organization. It later got changed to be known as the South African Students Congress. And in our district, we were in the Mohodumo district. We called it Moscow, Mohodumo Student Congress. As a result of that exposure, in 1986, when there was the state of emergency throughout the country, I was in my matric year. I became one of many young South Africans that got detained under the state of emergency regulations. And spent 6 months of my matric year in detention. And therefore, upon being released that December, had to look for a different school that wasn't a government school because I would not have been able to finish my matric in a government school or government registered, government associated school. I then ended up doing my matric in the following year at a private school called Promet College.
Okay. All right, that's interesting. And for university, what were some of your interests, career that you wanted to pursue? Were you one of those that were like, I want to be a lawyer as well? Because, I mean, everyone growing up wanted to be either a lawyer or a doctor, those conventional careers.
So my father encouraged me. The reason my parents enrolled me at SJ Van der Merwe Technical High School, I was an electronics student.
Okay.
It was the plan that I would become an electric engineer or something of that sort. So until my matric year, one of my subjects was electronics at SJ. Then while in prison, a number of people influenced my thinking, ranging from people like Prince Mafojane, Snakes Nyoka, and a few others that were in the SRC then at the University of the North, the then University of the North before it became University of Limpopo, through the traditions of Mkhabulo,
Okay.
There was one man that was much more instrumental of all of them, the late Thabo Makunyane,
yes,
who exposed us to some really deep thinking on the economy, on economics, on politics. And I was quite clear when I was released that I wasn't going to proceed with my path of being an electrical engineer, but actually I was going to go into commerce and economics.
That's interesting. It's almost like you did full circle back into that as well when you joined then the ESCOM, I suppose, the parastatals. But before we even go there, what was your first job in Ntate Makwana? Do you even remember it?
I do.
Okay.
It was at Church Square in Pretoria,
in
the then Department of Post and Telecoms before the department split into two entities. I was known as an assistant personnel beamte.
Ooh, okay.
Which means assistant human resources officer. As an intern graduate trainee at the department. 6 months later, I then got confirmed in terms of the probation period and immediately was put on what at the time was, we used to have a lot of these accelerated management trainee programs. And when the split happened, creating SA Post Office and Telkom SA, as it was known initially, I then found myself in with the accelerated program taking me into the SA Post Office, the first SOC that split Telkom and Post Office.
And then from there, what then happened? How did we get to be the chairperson of ESCOM?
I guess it's decades of experience. I first joined, got invited to join the board of ESCOM in 2002. At the time, I was managing director of Saatchi & Saatchi East Johannesburg. And so I just got a call from someone at the Department of Public Enterprises requesting my CV, that they were collecting CVs from people who were running things already as managing directors or the like. And based on my experience at the time in 2002, I then became one of the first cohort of the first group of men and women led by Dr. Ruel Khoza, who was a long-standing role model, confidant, counselor, you name it. And I was privileged to serve with him as the chair of that first commercial board of ESCOM between 2002 and 2005-06. He then handed the baton to Mr. Vali Musa, with whom we had as chair for 3 years. He was then succeeded by Mr. Bobby Godsell, from whom I took over. Initially took over from him and Mr. Maroha as interim CEO and chair of the board. And later became chair of the board alongside Brian Damas, who became CEO when I was chair.
Makes sense. Like you're saying, it's a whole lot of years right there. And in those years, what would you say were some of the challenges that you faced, or was it just a natural trajectory since you were MD at that stage?
Well, I guess already at that stage, I had been exposed to two significant projects that I think shaped my, let's call it, quality of thinking as a leader. Through an organization called the Center for Innovative Leadership, it's a scenario of thinking practice led by today's Professor Louis van Merwe. At that time, he had not yet become a professor. We got exposed to the notion of systems thinking and the school of work of scenario thinking. And so I got subcontracted by CIL as one of people that were called remarkable persons, which in scenario thinking language means that you are a sounding board that comes looking at processes outside in. We got to work with MTN. At the time, it was actually called MCell, transitioning into MTN, led by an American gentleman called Bob Chaffee. And the chairman of that board at the time was Mr. Saki Makozoma. And we helped them along, CIL helped them along with the MTN scenarios that looked at today's days when you're now seeing voice and data and all sorts of things being combined in a smartphone. At that time, all you could do with a cell phone is text and call. And that sort of settled my journey with technology and all things futurist. Later, CIL invited me into other projects with other blue chip companies that were doing similar future seeking exercises as the country was transitioning. These were all in the early in the mid 90s. The MTN project was around 96, 97. SA Breweries was around 97, 98, thereabouts.
Sure. Here's a question, Ntate Makwana. It says, Ntate Makwana seems to remember dates and times. How does it do that? I mean, I'm listening to you myself. I'm like, yo, you remember this and that, and this is what happened. Is that something that one cultivates intentionally?
Yes, you cultivate it in high school, really. There was this whole notion of various techniques of memory and information absorption. And so those techniques over time, when you're at university, you cultivate them further. And as you start working as a young professional, you cultivate them further. So there's a sense in which it was shaped over time, and perhaps there's a sense in which it is a natural talent, but it was cultivated over time.
What does Ntate Makwana see as some of the challenges that the country faces? I suppose this one goes to, you know, the broader leadership within the South African context. Your thoughts on that one? That's a question coming through as well.
So top of mind for me right now, especially when I accepted the role as adjunct professor at UNISA, there's a sense in which our country has reached a perhaps melting point, boiling point, turning point in terms of the various challenges that we face, where I believe that the average leader with my experience and capabilities should firstly step back in the spirit of intergenerational dynamics. And check really what is it we've inherited from the generations before us, be they baby boomers, be they the silent generation. And because I'm a Gen X. And secondly, what is it that as Gen Xers who are in our 50s and 60s, the young cohort of Gen Xers are in their mid 40s. What is it that we need to transfer to each other so that the day I get to sit under a tree and enjoy the shade as a retiree, what is it that I would have bequeathed? So the model that is constantly ringing in my head derives from the work, is inspired by the work of a man called Simon Arnold, who has been shaping what is called a Good Country Index. And it's really in simple terms, what is it that we need to cultivate as a country in terms of what else should we be respected for? So if you look at our country, there's a lot of wonderful things that South Africa is respected for, and we forget this in the midst of all this noise. If you think of the SKA out there in the Northern Cape, in around the Sutherland area, we are a world first in developing this telescope, of course, in partnership with many other scholars elsewhere in the world. But there's this telescope that has been developed that can look billions and billions of years into history in terms of figuring out the galaxy and so on. Sounds all convoluted. But if you just think about the scientific depth of that task, and what it says for South Africa, I think we're missing a huge opportunity to constantly say, how do we keep young Africans, particularly as the majority, from coming from the majority of the population, being keenly interested to become those future thought leaders in that part of science and technology?
If
you look at advances in energy,
yeah.
I mean, it is very little spoken of, but in the period of between 2002 and 2011, when that first commercial board of Eskom was in office, one of the global cutting-edge exercises was three things. A concentrated solar power was approved, which is currently housed in the Northern Cape, just outside Upington, where you could, for the world first in doing a 100-megawatt it's called concentrated solar power. It's now come to fruition. That research must be looked at in terms of how we start doing things at that scale of solar. The other area, in the area of coal, Eskom, through its R&D, did some remarkable work in this area of underground coal gasification, where you take the fact that we've got 400 years worth of unmined coal in most parts of our country, our coal has got low sulfur. And so that plant showed that you could cultivate energy from low sulfur, low coal, and therefore low emission by taking the CO2, extracting it back into the ground and burning the coal without the CO2 and almost turning it into an acceptable green energy source. And so I think that cutting-edge knowledge has been somewhat forgotten. It should come back and be thrown into the mixture of us looking for constantly for alternative energy solutions.
That's amazing.
These are just but few. There are many other inventions from our country. But the noise around politics, state capture, and many things, I think, have made us forget those cutting-edge things.
I'm shocked myself. 400 years there. That's an amazing one. There's a question around what do you think is the role of young people in shaping our future? But before that one, Tate Makwan, I wanted to go back just a little bit on the Eskom one. What were the highs and lows for you when you were the board chairperson?
In the first term or the second term?
Let's start with the first term.
The first term, I think a lot of good things stood out. When we as a collective got appointed in April 2002, Eskom was a shining light. After in 2001 it had been awarded the stature of the Global Power Utility of the Year. And so Eskom was renowned as the home of best practice of all things good and all things excellent and all things ethical. In the FIFA World Cup in 2010, it was quite a privilege to then be chair of the board, substantive chair of the board, and also to have led the team that kept the lights on during the FIFA World Cup. In terms of the second term, we worked quite hard as a board collective after we were appointed to try and rekindle some of that magic. And so we went through various kind of reigniting of the talent in the organization. And so when Mr. Beginumalo, the current head of Eskom Generations, was appointed, it was as a result of that journey, and as I've said previously, it wasn't a fluke that we had the good winter that South Africa enjoyed. It was because good efforts had been put in place to stabilize, firstly, the team leadership at power stations. One of the things that is not my doing, but just something to celebrate, is that, you know, some of the power stations that have got the highest energy availability factor consistently are run by women. Black African women, a very good, again, confidence builder for the average Black African young woman who's an engineer or aspirant engineer, that there are women already doing it. And so there's role models to follow, to emulate, to interact with. And so as a young person from Skukuni or wherever, you can aspire to become a great engineer that espouses excellence.
Yeah, sure. Someone is saying he is nice to listen to. So there you go, Ntate Mangwe.
Thank you very much. Please bless the soul of that company.
Yes. And then what went wrong, Ntate Mangwe, at Eskom, and which then subsequently led to you resigning?
I don't think it's pretty much what went wrong.
Yeah.
It's again a decision in leadership.
Okay.
If you suddenly find yourself in this constant, perhaps toxic environment, where the simplest of decisions are always pinned on an individual, as if though as chair of the board, you work as an individual.
Yeah.
The responsible thing to do is to offer yourself out of the picture.
Ah.
So that, you know, I said in my statement, I place the best interest of South Africa and the best interest of Eskom first. And that's what I did in my decision, that perhaps, you know, sometimes between leaders or in a leadership ecosystem, you may just find that there's just constant misunderstanding, misalignment that may unduly delay a good plan or a good path or a good trajectory.
Yeah.
And so the responsible thing to do is, as a leader who understands systems thinking, who understands, as I said earlier, about all things futurist, you then take a long-term view and say, perhaps at this point, in this context, at this current time, my job has a limit. We've managed to reignite the executive around a certain common purpose. We've managed to rekindle a sense of confidence among the various Eskom employees known as guardians. And so if that's the legacy one can leave in the short term, then perhaps step out of the way, let other leaders be invited on to step onto the platter, and let's see whether the best interest of Eskom and South Africa can continue to be served in keeping the lights on. And so far, I wish to compliment Dr. Nyati and the board for staying the course and keeping the lights on.
Fantastic. Sure, that's a I'm going to remember this part. As a leader, sometimes the best you can do, the responsible thing, is just to offer yourself out of leadership. Ntate Mangwe, you know, this leadership thing, we all want to lead, you know, come what may. And even if sometimes our leadership, and that's what I'm also learning, we force things, even if they're going to, are not in the best interest of the organization or the business as well. My colleague who left before me does a show from 3 to 6 p.m. It's an afternoon drive. So he has one question for you. And I need to ask this question to keep my job in the Demagwana one. So I must. So he asked me to ask you, is there such a thing called load shedding?
Yes, load shedding is a scientific term in the electricity generation business and in the transmission system operation business. It's not, we may have first heard it in South Africa, but various countries call it by different names.
Okay.
Remember, there's a simple purpose of load shedding is to protect the grid.
The grid, yes.
The purpose of load shedding is not to punish citizens. Is to protect the grid. So it is in the best interest of the nation that when the system operator based in Germiston recognizes that there's an imbalance between supply and demand, and so the grid could be compromised, the proactive thing to do is to mitigate the prospect of a brownout. Because if you end up with a California situation, which is where the first act of brownouts occurred, and therefore that's the first catastrophic load shedding. It was in California decades ago. You then anticipate and proactively manage the system such that if you rotate the load and shed from bits and pieces of the grid in the country, you preserve the integrity of the grid in the best interest of security of supply for the country. It is painful, but actually it's something that is being done for our greater good.
It is painful, that I won't lie to you.
It is.
When you go for 4 hours.
For me, all of us.
Oh, okay. You know, maybe we don't understand this grid thing and the importance of keeping the lights on and not having that California, you know, incident. Maybe that's maybe what makes us not to appreciate the efforts there.
I think that's back to your point that you raised earlier about what can South Africans do to help build a better country.
Yeah.
The first thing I would say, we must guard against being myopic. When I was in the banking sector, when we dealt with the banking issues relative to the Amabungani reports and state capture, the thing to always remember as citizens is that state capture, we may have labeled it state capture in South Africa, but actually globally, it is known as kleptocracy.
Okay.
And so any place in the world, there are people who seek to benefit from their close proximity with the people that are in power. And so if we all were to start discerning best practices in uprooting, outrooting kleptocracy, we would then appreciate the broader picture of what is it that you must do where you work, where you have whatever modest sphere of influence in ensuring that you don't have a bunch of kleptocrats, you know, hoarding a certain sphere of our society or our economy. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying it is not uniquely South African. Perhaps in South Africa, in the last bit with the commission that we all witnessed, it certainly has had a debilitating effect on various aspects of our work and lives. Certainly, no sphere of the economy escaped that kleptocracy.
That makes sense. That makes sense. I've got about two. But
really, it's a global issue. Just like if you understand that in Australia, they've had load shedding. Currently, in Japan, they have a version of load shedding. In India, they've had load shedding. In Vietnam, they came out of load shedding by putting 3,000 megawatts of rooftop solar across their nation. So there are case studies, there are experiences to learn from. And so that's why I keep on going back to the Good Country Index, because if you follow the work of Simon Arnold, it also exposes you to what countries are doing in the innovative space. We need to stop looking at the rear view mirror. We should learn from it, but let's rather start looking forward onwards in terms of innovative thinking. So the average young person must say, as I go to university, what innovative discoveries can I make in my area so that I help build, contribute towards a robust, thriving nation?
Love that, love that. We've got about a minute, Ndate Mokoena, and I must ask this question. How would you characterize your relationship with money?
Money is something you must have a respectful relationship with, in my view. It's something that, you know, there's the good old adage that the focus of your attention is what you become. If you treat money with respect, money takes you as from point A to point C rather than limiting you from point A to point B. If you relate to money as a thrift spender, as a... You know, there's this culture that is evolving in our country of conspicuous consumption. And often people want to show off money they don't have. So as Africans particularly, I want to emphasize, we need to understand that when you, on your TikTok or Instagram, show off your luxury brand, I won't mention brand names, but your luxury branded sunglasses, luxury branded handbag, luxury branded this and the other, it doesn't make you wealthy. It just makes you a pretender that is brandishing things they actually couldn't afford, if you were to be brutal, and wanting to appear to have wealth. And when month end comes, you're cracking your head to pay rent, you're cracking your head to pay for your car, you're cracking your head to do all the things that you should do, because all you did was you wanted to join the trend and the cohort of friends that are in this movement of conspicuous consumption.
Yeah, sure. What would be one thing you would change if you were to go back? What is the one thing that you think you'd do differently?
To go back where?
If you were to just redo certain things in your life as you take, like our politicians would normally say, with hindsight.
You know, they say every experience you have prepares you for the next challenge.
Okay.
Some of the experiences may be disruptive.
Yeah.
But if you are in, so firstly, you must have a clear sense of life purpose. That's the first thing I tell people I engage with.
Yeah.
Understand what that life purpose channels you, inspires you to contribute.
Yeah.
Once you are clear with that, you then will know how to connect the dots and pieces of what I said earlier about every challenge prepares you for the next assignment.
That's beautiful. Young people listening right now, what would be your message to them?
My message to the average young person is take charge of your destiny.
Yeah.
Be solutions oriented. Think constantly about building a bright future, a better future, because the future is the only place you were thinking about, because that's where you're going to spend a lot of your time.
So
rather than lament your current reality and lament your parents' past, we all have had to build something from nothing. I didn't get anything on a silver platter. And Nochal, I'm a firstborn, so I've had to pave the way for my siblings. So you always have to be clear that the world doesn't owe you anything. Yes, we constantly find ourselves in tough environments as Africans, but have a clear sense of, you know, one of the things I used to teach people when I was in my early career as a change agent, change organizational development specialist, is this notion of putting your life on a collage. I think we should also do something else as young people. Put your country on a collage. Have a collage that says, this is the country I wish to live in. This is the country I wish to work in. This is the country I wish to thrive in. And start putting visual images of what that country looks like. And juxtapose that with your personal collage as to how does your personal collage dovetail with that future. And I think you'll find that you'll be naturally drawn. Because remember, as I said, the focus of your attention is what you become.
Sure. That's beautiful. That's really beautiful. Ntate Makwane, thank you so much, for joining us this evening. Really appreciate your time. I do think that there is a lot of wealth and knowledge and insights that we could still draw from you. So when you knock on your door again with my producer, Ntate Makwane, can you? I really enjoyed the conversation. And may God truly bless you with your endeavors as well. And I suppose our listeners, where can they follow you? I know you've got LinkedIn.
Firstly, let me say Kia Leboha.
Thank you so much.
Also request the Almighty God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to bless you.
Thank you so much.
I have a personal website, www.line3, all in words, no numbers, line3, one word, .co.za. I'm present on X, but I'm not as vicious on X as people are. I only contribute thoughts and leave it to people. I am on Facebook as a contributor of thought. So I'm generally easy to follow.
Yes. Okay. Thank you so much, Tata. Have a good one.
Ralebo.
Thank you so much.
You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
Sure. My heart is